Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. Now, before we begin, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. Welcome. My name is Clayton Platt, and I am the host of Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time, and I'm really honored today to have my guest, Dr. Michael Platt. He is a renowned neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and his work reveals how the brain shapes decision-making, social connection, and leadership. And as director of the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, he brings science into the boardroom, translating research into practical tools for presence, empathy, and impact. And if you've ever wondered how awareness shapes action in real time, I think this conversation should be for you. So, Dr. Michael Platt, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Clayton. Some long-lost third, fourth cousin, something along the line. Good to be here.
I'm honored by the possible connection there. The last name has a ring to it. So, Yeah. You know, as we begin, I'm reminded of something we talked about when we first had a connection, and you were telling me about this live demo that you were doing, and it was like science in real time, and you were, I believe, monitoring heartbeats, and the heartbeats of the participants were shown up on a screen. And if I'm not mistaken, you had chosen audience members who had clearly no connection. And they might have been very different builds, large, small, different cultures, right? And putting them on stage together and asking them to, I think, build something with Legos.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So it's first of all, you know, beware anytime you attempt to do science live, it's usually going to fail. But it's so exciting to do it, and it really makes it very real and tangible for folks in the audience. And really, the goal of this demo was to demonstrate this phenomenon of physiological synchrony, which is really a fundamental discovery in the last decade. In neuroscience. And it's the observation that when we have a good connection with somebody, when we are connected to them, that our brains actually synchronize. This percolates down to our bodies, so our hearts start to beat together, we breathe together, we move together. And as it turns out, you can run it in reverse by breathing together, moving together, et cetera. So what I did in this demo, again, don't try this at home, was to, you know, I brought in a bag of Legos, you know, I got three boys, and dump them on the table, get two people in from the audience up, wire them up, put their heart rates up on the screen. And of course, you know, at rest, their hearts are beating at different times. They're, as you mentioned, they're, you know, different body size, different age, different physical fitness. So of course you would expect that. But here's the key. So I would ask them to, without speaking, start to build a vehicle on their own. So they start, you know, finding pieces and putting wheels on, and their heartbeats are still, you know, all over the place. And then I would say, okay, now I want you to build one together, but I don't want you to talk. And so as they start to do that, and they look at each other, they look at the vehicle, they're alternating, coordinating, cooperating, right? And when, as they begin to do that, their heartbeats start to come into alignment, which is sort of really miraculous. It works every time. And the observation I've had as well is I've done this demo with many different kinds of groups. And when you bring people in, you know, up there whose lives depend on really being able to dial in with a teammate, like so people in special forces or who are in, for example, wild firefighters, they just go, you know, it's like, and that, what we've learned over the last decade is that synchrony is a biological marker of closeness that predicts trust and cooperation, teamwork, communication, associated with empathy. It seems to be a universal. And in fact, now we and other groups have discovered that the same physiological principle underlies social cohesion, social connection in animals too. So in monkeys and in bats, and birds, and which I think is really quite profound. And kind of getting back to that, what I said earlier about the fact that you can, we just naturally sync with some people and less so with others. But the fact that there are things you can do to get in sync, and one of those things is moving together, right? So it turns out that like mirroring each other or drumming, like hippies playing drums in the park, why are they doing that? What they're doing is they're synchronizing their physiology and they're creating a sense of closeness and good feeling. This is what the great sociologist in the 19th century, I believe, Emile Durkheim, he talked about this phenomenon of collective effervescence, which is the feeling you get when you do something with other people, like singing Christmas carols together, going to you're at a football game and then play the national anthem or something. The question is like, why do we do these things together? Why do we go to a movie theater to watch a movie together or go to live music together? Because we experience this collective effervescence, which is the biological glue that enables cooperation and teamwork and all the associated good feelings that come with that.
Yeah, and it really breaks down what might be outgroups otherwise when you've created this opportunity to create this synchronicity. I notice that when I go to a Phillies game.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, people that I might not have anything else in common with, we got the red hat on, we got the Harper jersey, and bingo.
Right? Yeah. It's just an outward signifier that kind of it puts your attention, if you will, and attention is critical to our brain function. It's one of the things we can really control. Putting that attention on what's shared rather than what's different is a way that helps to build connection. It opens your mind to inclusion of that person when otherwise it might not be so open. And that's why things I think like uniforms, for example, help to create, cohesion and connection between people.
Yeah. And I've been seeing more and more about that and how even in an organization where a uniform might not be, pro forma, so to speak, that finding a way that there's something that people can share that is indicative of their, shared purpose can be helpful.
Yeah, I think there's a really good example of this. And this is actually in a different space, it's sort of in the business side of things. But in brand communities like Apple, for example, Apple is an extremely strong brand community, really high brand loyalty compared to other brands like in the smartphone business like Samsung. And we've been super interested in that for a while. And what we found is that the Apple community, their brains are highly synchronized and they respond to ads, they respond to news kind of in lockstep with each other. And I think that the people who work at the Apple store and they're all wearing the same t-shirts and you're all having the same experience and you've got the same operating system, it really does create this sense of community and shared mindset. And whereas we don't see that in Samsung, Galaxy owners at all. Very similar, we see the exact same patterns in grocery store brands, shoppers. So, Trader Joe's has, fanatics. And our Trader Joe's customers are also in sync with each other, whereas Whole Foods customers are not. And, you can just think about all the ramifications of the way people connect with each other online and they share with each other, attention to, people in that community. It does raise a bit of a question about, like, if you're not in that community and then you're not in sync, right? And so you're kind of actually seeing the world potentially very differently and feeling very differently about it. I think we can. You can imagine what's going on, for example, in polarized political bubbles, for example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I, as you were talking and trying to keep my focus on what you were saying and not have my mind wander, what the image that came up was rallies and rallies with hats and flags, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. And it's occurred to me, regardless of what side of the aisle one may sit on, the call to action and the call to join the collective, so to speak, of a certain look seems to be very effective.
It's super effective. And that, also speaks to, I think, another phenomenon that right now is gaining a lot of attention, which is charisma. I think for the longest time, we didn't really know scientifically what it is. I'm not sure we truly understand it. But one of the things about a charismatic speaker, charismatic leader, is that what they are able to do is to, in a sense, synchronize the physiology, synchronize the brains of all the people that they're speaking to. They can get them all locked in with each other to the brain of the speaker. So we know from other work that more effective communication is the way it does that is by synchronizing the brains of more people together. So advertisements that have the same impact on more people in terms of brain activity, moments of brain activity, actually do better. So an ad that's really good at synchronizing brains is one that's going to translate into higher sales, for example.
Yeah. And thinking about how this weaves back into the theme of mindfulness in real time is that the awareness of a leader or a manager or someone with an impactful position that this needs to be taken into account. What lands, what causes this synchronicity goes beyond the underlying core message. It's like, but how is the message delivered?
Right. Yeah. How is the message delivered? What are the physical characteristics of the person who's delivering the message? I mean, we know that that's important, maybe not rationally important, but our brains, have a built-in heritage of not only what our species has experienced over, millennia, but even beyond that. So even factors that shouldn't be so important, like just what a person looks like, can have an impact. But I think what you're saying is important when we think about, the focus of your podcast here in terms of mindfulness and meditation and various kinds of practices is that an instructor, a guru, a yogi. I do yoga, that's my piece of the meditation puzzle here. That person, their presence, right, is if they have presence, I should say, that can be really, really helpful in terms of the quality of your experience and how deeply you go into it. Eventually, you don't need it, right? But it takes a long time.
Yeah, and you were mentioning along these lines, the is it didactic? Is that how it's pronounced? Didactic.
So they're right. They're most probably the meditation practices that most people are aware of and that have been studied the most in terms of neuroscience are ones that are individual practices. Where you're mindfulness, where you're kind of observing your own thoughts and focus on that, or there's kind of mind expanding kinds of meditation or awe based meditation, different sorts of practices. But those are all kind of done as an individual. I mean, you might be with other people, but it's, the focus is on not on the other people. But we have a couple of studies led by a former postdoc in the lab, Vera Ludwig, that expand the notion of meditation and mindfulness to two people, where the other person is actually a focus of the practice, and so there's a couple of different, there's several different versions of this that we've looked at. For example, just sitting and kind of looking at each other, meditating on the other person, including a mantra, if you will. So something you meditate on your shared humanity. Like this is a person who has felt pain and joy, and et cetera, just like me. Just expressing to that person, observing your own thoughts and feelings and expressing them to the other person, or having a conversation, which you can think of as a sort of a kind of meditation, if you will. We don't think of it that way. But all of those, what we found, engage some similar processes. And at the core of that is a synchronization of physiology between the two people. So even just when we make eye contact with somebody, our brains begin to synchronize. Actively meditating on their humanity increases that synchrony. We resonate at a higher level. Listening to someone, attentively listening, but not offering judgment, does the same thing as well. I mean, having a conversation does too, but the more intentional kind of expression and reception and meditation on that person's current state and their humanity dials up synchrony. And when it does so, that has a number of benefits. It increases perceived closeness, psychological closeness. You like the person more. It reduces stress in the form of like heart rates go down, heart rate variability goes up, which is a marker of a reduction in stress. And you become more charitable toward that person. So actually we measure that not asking questions, but using economic games. So like a dictator game, I just give you a pile of money and you decide how much you would like to share with the other person. And when you think about and meditate on their humanity, that they're a person just like you, and you start to resonate with them, which kind of what it does is it breaks down the barrier between you. It's inclusion of the other person and yourself. Then of course it stands to reason that you're more generous with that person, because it's like being generous with yourself.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there could be really wonderful implications about using that, for example, in the workplace, a startup, beginning of a new project, dealing with someone who's been brought in from a different department or new hire. Have you seen evidence of that? Has that been part of research, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, it is a motivation for a lot of the work that we're doing. And I would say this, that most companies are not going to be ready to embrace something as intense as this dyadic meditation. But instead, what we have done, we worked with a number of companies on this, is to use this structured set of questions. They are actually developed by this husband-wife team of the Aarons back in the 1990s, and it's designed to build closeness, so it's called Fast Friends. And it starts with very kind of superficial, chit-chat kind of questions that move to something very deep. You know, questions that are really deep, like, even easy ones, like, who would you want to have dinner with and why? And if you start thinking about it, that can go really deep. But other questions like, whose death would affect you most and why? I mean, that's like, wow, that's pretty hard. That process of having that kind of starting superficial and going to deep questions takes two people who don't know each other, right? And it compresses the process of becoming friends, which might take months, and it compresses it to like 45 minutes. Yeah. And what happens is you see that in people who don't know each other, their brains start out very far apart and they come very close together. You see heart rates synchronize. And we've used this all over the world. It works everywhere. So it's independent. This is a cultural universal. We even used it in a pretty interesting intervention during the pandemic. So we were approached by a woman named Paula Mara, who was the CEO of this collective called Matriarca. So it's a collective of indigenous women artisans in Argentina who use traditional weaving techniques to make these beautiful bags and ponchos and textiles, fetch a good price on the market. But they had this problem, which is that the women in neighboring villages didn't trust each other because they'd been fighting for decades, and they certainly didn't trust management. And so what we did is we had students translate all the questions into Spanish. They got online and had round-robin lessons in teaching these women in indigenous communities how to use Zoom. And then they set up all these Zoom conversations between women in different communities and with management, using this structured game, if you will. And, we couldn't measure brain activity. We were trapped here, but we knew what happened. And what they found was that trust increased, the barriers went down, and everybody started to get along. And it worked out so well that management, eventually they gave the collective to all the women so that we became self-owned, which was a really wonderful outcome. One of the things that we've done for companies is to make it a little bit more digestible. It's like a long process. Is you can take one of these questions and use it as an icebreaker at every team meeting. So it's the underlying principle is the same, which is sharing and listening. And when you tell your story, which is essentially what this is, right? You have to be a little vulnerable. Authentic people listening, we don't know exactly what happens, but somehow that process of sharing creates connection, and it also synchronizes our brain activity.
So what's interesting, what I was hearing there was the depth of this, of these questions and conversation. It's important to be able to have a conversation. I'm thinking about icebreaker, and yeah, we've all done those, and it's like, what TV character would you like to play? Blah, 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 whatever, yeah. Right? Fine.
Right.
But involving something that exhibits a little more vulnerability seems to speed up the process of synchronicity and takes you at a deeper level and creates that bond more quickly.
Right. That's right. That's
right. And it makes me think of, and I don't know where I heard, maybe on a podcast, about a study about, it was the London subway research. And they had subjects go in and actually start conversations with people on the subway.
Yeah.
Does that resonate? Does that sound familiar at all?
It sounds familiar. I don't remember the outcome.
Right. So basically the outcome was, it was people were very resistant at first, but they realized that they could actually have conversations with complete strangers. And the deeper the conversation got, more quickly, the more the person responded, and the more that became something that was meaningful to both of them. And it's like, oh, interesting. So not being afraid, it sounds like, to go to have a icebreaker that creates a little vulnerability can be something that speeds that process and starts building those connections more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we don't understand why necessarily, but so there's must be, we presume there's some cascade of processes in the brain that begin with attending to the other person and kind of letting down your guard and you're vulnerable for a moment. But then that's where the magic happens. I can't say that I know. I will say this. We've done some research kind of connecting some of these dots. So synchrony being kind of the key connection here, which is when we make eye contact, our brains begin to synchronize. When we make eye contact, that also leads to the release of oxytocin in the brain. Oxytocin is a chemical. It's sometimes called the love hormone. It has a number of different roles in the brain and in the body. But it does two things in the brain. One is it kind of turns up social processing networks, and it turns down stress. So it's an anxiolytic, much better than any drug that you could get from CVS or from your doctor. And it's one of those things that actually... I think that we crave, and we crave because it's, again, it's how we're built, right? That's how we're wired. And so many of the sources through which we would normally get this oxytocin release have been removed from our lives. Mm-hmm. So, we don't know whether that can be generated. It can be generated maybe, online through online interactions, but it's for sure going to be much more powerful in person, where you can actually make eye contact. I can't make eye contact with you right now, just given the offset of the camera and the screen. Physical touch, for example, social touch, appropriate warm human contact is a powerful trigger of oxytocin release. And when we're at home, when you're locked in your room, in your remote, you can't have that, And that, again, that's an ancient heritage. I mean, all mammals, monkeys, mice, you name it, all have that that mechanism for helping to build bonds and to reduce stress and reduce anxiety. And we're starving ourselves of that, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is an unfortunate ramification of hybrid and remote work, which we could go into that. But I'm thinking, tying again back to sort of the formal meditation practice around self-compassion. And one of the things that is often advised by teachers, and I'll do this, is when we're doing loving kindness, we're doing self-compassion, actually suggesting, if it's comfortable, put your hand on your heart, or wrap your arms around yourself. And if I'm putting two and two together, what I'm hearing is that is actually then helping trigger a flow of oxytocin.
Maybe,
right. I mean,
so here's how I would, the reason I say maybe, I presume that it will, just by dint of the fact that there's specific sensors in our skin, in the hairy parts on our skin, that are dedicated to this, to detecting human touch, right? It doesn't tell you much about pressure or location, but it responds best to body temperature, human body temperature, and kind of like, really nice little, rubbing like that. So it should work. Now, the only thing, the hedge here is that is the observation, it's very hard to tickle yourself. Okay, so with different sensors, different mechanism in your skin, but we do have this this process in our brains that sort of cancels out self-generated sensory inputs, right? Mm-hmm. So that just because we're moving all the time, if we were feeling all those things to the same degree that we were feeling external impacts on our body, then that would be overwhelming. And there actually was a really thought-provoking study by a guy named Dan Wolper a couple decades ago that implicated this in force escalation. So this was a really interesting study where they had two people who were supposed to apply the same degree of force to somebody else that had been applied to them. The problem is that you feel that force more strongly than what you feel directed to yourself. And so it sort of ratchets up. And, I don't know if it may be a leap, but the implication being that, we tend to feel for good and for bad the inputs that are coming from the outside to a greater degree than what's self-generated.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, just as we're kicking this around, that perhaps in that exercise of doing some meditation, using a mantra, that there's a verbalization. Mm-hmm. And many times the instruction may be that verbalization be, in essence, directed sometimes third person. Mm-hmm. And I've had interesting conversations with sports psychologists around using third person self-talk, being more powerful way to help calm, help deal with mind chatter, et cetera, to build that sense of coming back into the present, being, Clayton, do this, as opposed to I will be present, but Clayton, right. Get yourself present. Don't know. Who knows?
I don't know either.
Well, I love that. So sure. There we go. We're demonstrating the beginner's mind, the I don't know mind. And, that's frankly, again, something in my world around teaching meditation is trying always to come back to that. It's like, don't assume you know everything.
Right, right. No, I think that's critical. That's something that also plays a role in our research and something that we that we teach and we teach in executive education programs. So specifically with regard to perspective taking and the realization that the way you see the world is not the way other people see the world, right? And it can be very, very different. And it's one of our superpowers that we have as human beings to be able to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, empathy in some sense, but also even the cognitive aspects of the perceptual aspects. But we so often don't. And so one of the ways that we like to demonstrate this is to we bring people to the Barnes Foundation, museum, for example, which is great. It's just a priceless collection. But one of the things that's so fascinating about it is first, the way the art is displayed, which is not typical. It's not by era, it's not by whatever. And there are no placards to tell you what you're supposed to be seeing. So talk about beginners, mindset. The untrained eye. I think it was Matisse talked about. And so we have people. They go in small groups and they pick a piece of art and then they stare at it for 10 minutes or so, and then they describe to each other what they see. And what we find is that people see very different things. And then you realize that you're making assumptions and you are dragging along your own biases. And it's a very powerful lesson that translates extremely well to the boardroom. In fact, I'll make this very concrete for everybody, which is people probably remember the big internet craze over the dress, this dress that a woman wore to a wedding, and some people see it as white and gold striped, and other people see it as blue and black striped, And, you know, if you show it, you'll go, you say, I see this, I always see this white and gold. And other people will be like, it's impossible. You're wrong. You can't see it that way. It's the other. And, you know, people will fight over this. And that's why it created such a stir. And as it turns out, this is one of these, features of brain function that is deeply tied to your, not only your experience, but how you're wired. So it's very fundamentally determined by whether you're a morning person or a night person, which is itself very strongly genetic. So morning people who are up really early, tend to see it as white and gold. People who are more like night owls see it the other way. And that reflects the kind of illumination that your brain has come to expect. So morning people more often seeing kind of morning incident sunlight, and people who are night owls are operating under incandescent or fluorescent light. And that just makes things look different. And so without other contextual cues, it just leads you to see this completely differently. We ran a pilot study in one of our partner companies. It was over the past year, which was really interesting because we measured people's, whether they're night owls or morning larks, okay, with the standard validated questionnaire. And we had them look at that. And then we measured brain activity during just team meetings. Actually, my son was involved in this. It was pretty fun. It was his senior thesis. And what we found is that people who are not the same chronotype being with your morning person or night person, did not synchronize. Okay. The only thing they synchronized on was negative emotions. So as conversations went along, what happened was people who basically wired to see the world differently, even at a perceptual level, tend to be more conflict during the course of a team meeting. And if you're more aligned with people in terms of chronotype, then you're more synchronized on positive emotions, because you're kind of presumably because you're seeing the world and seeing that situation in a much more similar way. Nobody's taking this into account. This is like so fundamental. And then when you think about, we brought up remote work, hybrid work, you got people in different time zones and different parts of the planet, all kinds of things.
That blows my mind. That really blows my mind, and I'm remembering that craze. And I need to go back and check it out with my wife, who's a night owl, and I'm a morning person. That would be really funny, and it would explain a lot. But this whole sense of connection, and the work you've done, the research you've done, and the things that have come out of this research about the importance of connection in terms of longevity for life, but also in terms of how we deal in the day-to-day life and deal with our colleagues, our teammates, our companies. And what I'd love to do is sort of connect this perspective, because to me, that's plays right into the world I walk in and sort of trying to understand how we build perspective from a mindfulness standpoint as an aid, right? Just another way, right? Just another tool to bring ourselves into a position to understand how someone else is seeing something differently. But also then that being an aid to further connection.
Yeah.
And sure. So I would imagine you've seen that, and are there things that you've seen have worked, sort of techniques and tools that have worked, and what might they be?
Well, I mean, we've talked about some of them. I mean, we were kind of in some ways working down the list of team building or trust building exercises and seeing, are they really having the predicted impact on our physiology or not? So deep conversation, singing together, chanting together, moving together, which are, those are fundamental components of basically every culture on the planet, every culture on the planet has these rhythmic activities that people engage in together. And it's my belief that that's there because that helps to build connection. That's literally the glue that allows us to cooperate and to work together, and to not fight, all those things. If you, think about the military, for example. When you join the military, you get drafted, or whatever. What do you spend basic training doing? You march together a lot. why? Because you wear a uniform. But marching, I think that's an activity that is designed to synchronize brain activity. Training together. So one of the studies we did was here with Penn's rowing team. And of course, when you're rowing on a boat with other people, the best, most efficient way to move the boat through the water is to move in synchrony with each other, which is really hard to do. That's why you have a cox who's kind of yelling out the stroke. And one of the things we found was that we measured brain activity, heart rate activity, rowers who were doing dry land training. That's like over at the boathouse, and you got a bunch of erg machines, rowing machines. And the typical way that the training will be done is you go, it's training time, you go and you just get on your erg by yourself, and everybody's doing their own thing. So that's one condition, that's sort of standard condition. We had another condition where we lined up all the erg machines, and we connected them with a bar that forced them into physical synchrony. Mm. Okay. And then the third condition was just not having that bar, but you're still training next to each other. Okay, so you can see each other, you can hear each other. And what we found is that, of course, when you force people into synchrony, we see physiological synchrony. But even if you're just next to each other, like you're doing the training you would normally do alone, people synchronize, their heart rates synchronize, their brain activity synchronize. And this created this phenomenon that is the goal in rowing, which is called swing. And you can think of what swing is it's group flow. So, and it's in fact how we measured it. It's like you feel like you're pulling on the same oar together. It's not like you're all pulling on one. It's one thing. And, that's the predictor of performance. And, what's the implication? I mean, we haven't tried this in every situation, but if you're going to be doing something together at some point that would benefit from teamwork, then any opportunity you have to train together to do that, you should take advantage of, because it's an opportunity to build this underlying synchrony that you're more likely to show up and sync with those individuals at a later time.
Really fascinating. So I'm thinking, translating from the shell into the conference room. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about ritual. So we're thinking about an organization where perhaps singing and dancing in the morning might not work. Maybe some company culture will embrace that, but having certain rituals that people can count on that brings them together. I've heard throughout our conversations the importance of movement, and that can be awkward in some work environment, but having some rituals that kind of remind you, this is where you're at. This is what expected of you. This is what happens. Your mind, is plugged in a certain way in this environment. Does that make sense? How does that show up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can't off the top of my head think of companies that are doing that, but I know that there are companies that do that. And I think in every way that would be beneficial. It does require that everybody buys into it, right? So if people are not sincere, right, then they're going to have very different
right.
experience. And that's another feature of social, of any of these social exercises, I think is sincerity. Authenticity, we talked about before. So, you know, our brain, everything that we're talking about here is mediated by this, what we call social brain network, social interaction network, that's basically dedicated to managing our moment-to-moment interactions with others as well as our long-term relationships. So it's you know, it's perception, attention, feelings, and action. And that system is very sensitive to BS, okay? so, it's like when we're sincere, we engage more and different muscles in our face than if we're BSing. So that's the difference between a good actor and a bad actor. That's why method acting became so dominant, because the sort of stilted facial expressions, you know, affect of an individual who's, in a sense, acting, faking it, it's very different from somebody who's genuinely feeling it, right? You actually have to feel it. So, I think that is an important part of everything we're talking about here, which is however you do that, you've got to somehow open yourself up to the true emotional experience. Because if you don't, then the whole process is going to be different. And what other people's brains can read from your face and your body is going to tell them that you're not.
Yeah. Because I was thinking about, you know, and I think you and I may have talked about this before, taking that moment before a meeting, you know, and sort of getting quiet. So you're in the moment, right? And that's, let's face it, in our world, whether it's remote or in person or hybrid, whatever, getting ourselves in sync in terms of, I'm here right now. I'm with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's hard.
Yeah.
our attention's pulled in so many different ways. But finding whatever works in order for people to be able to acknowledge, looking around the room at some point, that they are all actually there. And that there's sincerity and authenticity around that. That it's not just, you know, the face, but it's actually the full being. And finding ways to actually have perhaps a routine around that, some kind of little ritual.
Yeah.
But I think it would have to be something that, as you said, people need to buy in.
Yeah.
And if they're going to buy in, maybe it's something where you give different members of the team the opportunity to introduce, let's try this today.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows at some point they're going to have to be sort of, you know, put on the spot with that. So I think there's a little bit of empathy can build for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And therefore it's like, okay, so today I'd like to try this. And, you know, next week it's going to be Fred. The week after that, it's Mary. But everybody then saying, here's my time. And building some empathy is and that ritual, even in and of itself, could be a way to say, okay, we're all in the same market. We're all here together now.
Yeah. I totally agree. another way to do this is games. So, games that require you to pay attention to the other people around you and to the context. And play and playfulness is actually, you know, it's something that's critical to human connection. I mean, there's a reason why we, you know, our part of our you know, makeup is that we play into adulthood, and that's pretty unusual. And play is it's something we don't understand very well, but it you see it in all other animals basically, and it's is there for you to kind of. To help you build bonds through you know, interacting with another individual. My friend and colleague Emily Falk taught me this one game, which I think is really great because it engages perspective taking and attention, which is this game knife, angry cat baby. So it's like, you're like, you can even play it online. And, you know, you're like, okay, I've got a knife, you know, so, and I'm going to throw it to Clayton, and you got to catch the knife. And then you're going to, you're going to throw it to somebody else. And then as you're, somebody else is calling out that they're throwing it, then I say, oh, it just changed into an angry cat. You know, and so now the way you handle it is very different. And then at some point it changes into a baby. And, you know, so people are, you know, mimicking the kinds of, you know, actions that they, that would be appropriate for that moment. If you're not paying attention, then, you know, then you'll screw it up, and everybody has a good laugh. I don't know what it does to your brain, but it's super fun and engaging, and people enjoy it. I will, but kind of there's a bigger point that I want to make here right now, which is that none of this works if you've got your nose buried in a phone. So, like, the prerequisite for the ritual, the prerequisite for connection at a meeting or a dinner is being present, which means not being somewhere else. The infinity of other places you can be when you're staring at a screen, which unfortunately is where, you know, most people spend most of their time now.
Yeah, I loved what you were saying about the knife cat. It certainly reminds me of some improv training.
Yeah,
and you have to be right in improv. You've got to be there, and it's yes and. The one thing you can never say in improv is no.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing when you're talking about exercises, which is, you know, improv exercises, which were, you know, developed and discovered decades ago, turn out to be really effective for building synchrony between people. So the mirror game, for example, when you are trying to actively mirror somebody else and then you switch back and forth, that generates synchrony. And it lasts, and when you do that, that increases trust and goodwill toward the other person. That lasts for some time. And, you know, my hunch is that, like, basically all the really good improv games are that's what they do, because they are, that's what's required in improv, right? Is to riff off somebody else and to know where they're going, to be able to predict where they're going. You've got to be in sync with them. You got to be thinking similar things and seeing similar things and planning ahead in a very similar way.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't do it if you're half there.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, you mentioned the phone, and I think I've read recently about studies where not only just having the phone present.
Yep.
And what is that doing?
It's a distraction. Even if you're not looking at it, if it's in your pocket, you're thinking about it. That, you know, you've got it. It is where your attention is then divided, or your attention is there rather than what's in front of you. That's why the advice right now is to put it in another room. If there's something important you have to do, or when you go to sleep, don't have it in the room next to you, because it's calling, right? It's, you know, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, it's calling the way a slot machine is calling to somebody who's a gambling addict, or the way a heroin needle is calling to a heroin addict. That's what it is. It is designed, algorithmically designed, to capture your attention and hold your attention for as long as possible.
Having been on a number of week-long silent retreats, one of the things that is a ritual with these typically is you give up your phone.
Yeah.
And there is a ritual around giving it up and then getting it back. It's kind of fun. But I would tell you that the liberation is immediate. It is so interesting.
Yeah.
And I could feel my body relaxing and going into a different space as the phone was put into this, you know, container and moved away, and then noticing the difference when you get back. And it does not necessarily immediate, but over time,
yeah,
you know, you're like, oh my God, it's back. Yeah. And so I think this ties into our sense of mindfulness, of recognizing this is a pull of my attention. this is grabbing my focus. I don't have as much choice in this as I should, because there's a device that may ring in the text, and it's on my smartwatch, right?
Yeah. No, having younger sons, my youngest is 16. He always laments that he wasn't born, when I was, because the idea of growing up and having childhood where you didn't have, you weren't connect, you were in the moment, you were experiencing life, you were experiencing other people, you weren't worrying about, what's going on, whatever, Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, and Instagram. But that's where it is. And if you aren't there now, then you're kind of locked out of social life. So it's a real challenge. We were two nights ago, I was like, oh, have you seen the movie Almost Famous? He's very, and he hadn't seen it. So I was like, oh, let's watch it with mom. And, it's such a beguiling story because, as a kid his age who talks himself into writing for Rolling Stone and goes on tour with a band and is just having experiences and basically very innocent, very carefree, I would say. No danger, it's like it was, I think, I guess innocent in some ways is sort of how, I mean, obviously it's a movie, but still, it's a very different, when they're riding on the bus together, they're not staring at their phones, which is what they'd be doing now. They're talking to each other, they're playing music, they're actually in the moment, they're present.
So I was thinking, in a way, this feels like a reasonable way to kind of tie things together. For you, knowing you do yoga, and that's a wonderful way to be in touch with your body and to be able to sense what's occurring, and be grounded, etc. What other things, and would you say are Michael Platt's techniques to kind of bring yourself, one, to bring yourself into the moment, to perhaps give you the space to be creative, and then finally to make sure that you're in synchronicity with the folks around you?
I mean, it's a great question. So I used to engage in a lot of in visual arts. I haven't found time to do that, but something that I lose myself in. I have every intention of going back to doing that. Building on yoga, I've been an exercise junkie my whole life. Sports and just being athletic is a great way to be in the moment. I've been a CrossFitter for 20 years. High intensity exercise, you are in the moment. But the kind of synchronized part of that is music. I mean, I'm not a good musician, but I taught myself to play guitar when my middle son was picking up guitar because his teacher said, hey, he could use backup. So I was like, all right, I guess I'll do it. And then I got into playing with lots of friends, back when I was in North Carolina. And then my youngest son, who's the sort of the most musical of all the kids, is really into it. That is like a serious source of pleasure and synchronicity is playing together. Super fun.
There are a few things in life that beat that.
Yeah.
I'm right there. And I know when I'm lucky enough to be around people playing music or singing, there is an immediate connection. And I think we find that sometimes even, again, in the workplace, you'll be somewhere and all of a sudden you're like singing a song together, maybe not loud, and maybe not all verses, but you catch that and it's like, bingo, you're on the same page,
Yeah, exactly.
I want to thank you. This has been, for me, hugely enlightening. And I so value the work you do. I think that it's so important, and I think we're probably still sort of at the tip of the iceberg, right? Mm-hmm. So much we don't know, but I still appreciate the study of neuroscience and how it reinforces all of the stuff that we who try to teach meditation and mindfulness, it gives the foundation. It gives the, I like to say the Buddha was the original neuroscientist 2,600 years ago. Right.
There's a reason why these practices have persisted.
Yeah, there is. Well, thank you so much for your time today, for your insights and continued good work. And I look forward to seeing your name in the headlines more in the future. So cheers.
Thank you, Clay. Thank you.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Mary Ann Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes, and finally for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.